Welcome, everybody, to our live webinar, 9/11, An Architect's Guide, a three-part series. I'm Richard Gage, AIA member of the American Institute of Architects and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And that is former CEO of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I'm flying solo now, independent of AE 9/11 Truth. It's quite a story. You can learn more about it on my new website, richardgage911.org. That's richardgage911.org. Now, AE 9/11 Truth represents a growing body of now more than 3,500 architects and engineers signed on to their petition demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. This is part one of our webinar series, and it's about World Trade Center Building 7, the third tower, a 47-story skyscraper that collapsed suddenly and symmetrically into its own footprint in under 7 seconds at 5:20 in the afternoon of 9/11, of course. So just so you know something about my background, I was responsible. Oh, wait, before we get there, want to alert you to our new podcast series. I will be interviewing a series of highly influential people in the 9/11 Truth movement weekly on Thursday, usually. And so I hope you'll join us. That is Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. I can speak in greater detail about some topics just outside the fringe of the World Trade Center evidence. Which, when I was at AE 9/11 Truth, I was strictly bound by, and for good reason. So I encourage everybody to support the good people over at AE 9/11 Truth. We have an awesome relationship, and I will be sending petition signers and donors, including you, hopefully, over to ae911truth.org. You can also learn more now from my new series. But just so you know something about my background, I was responsible at a local firm in the San Francisco Bay Area for the construction documents for these $3 and $10 million gymnasiums and the construction administration for this $125 million high school. More recently, before launching full-time into this important outreach effort, I had similar responsibilities working on this $400 million mixed-use project near Las Vegas with six blocks of retail, mid-rise office space, and parking structure, altogether about 1,200 tons of fireproofed steel framing. I now work full-time educating architects, engineers, and others to understand what really happened at the World Trade Center using the material in these courses. So, with that said, did you even know about World Trade Center Building 7? I did not until 2006, May, and I was shocked to learn about this incredible set of evidence that I'm going to be sharing with you today, including this building. Most architects and engineers know nothing about the third worst structural failure in modern history, World Trade Center Building 7. I mean, it's incredible. This should be the most talked about structure in modern history. It wasn't hit by an airplane. It's 47 stories tall, about a football field away from the North Tower. And on the afternoon of 9/11, something happened. Now, this would be the tallest building in most of our states. Hang on one second. We're going to fix something here. And here we go. And here. That's going to be better for me. So it's just outside the superblock of the World Trade Center set of buildings. And again, it was the third skyscraper to collapse. This happens at 5:20 in the afternoon. Now, here it is standing in the morning just fine. The Twin Towers did not knock it over. There's a tiny well, some damage to the building from the debris, the steel beams that came down from the North Tower. But even NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress to explain these collapses to the American people, they acknowledged that this damage was not a significant factor in the building's collapse. We'll talk about what was, but as you can see, it's standing just fine here. Well, let's look at the collapse. The East Penthouse on the left falls 6 seconds early, with no damage underneath it visible on the exterior. And then the penthouse, the rest of the penthouse comes down, and then the entire building comes down, as you see. So we're going to be breaking this down today. First, let's listen to the official narrative put forth by Shyam Sunder of NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. What's the official story?
What we found was that uncontrolled building fires caused an extraordinary event. The collapse of World Trade Center 7 was primarily due to fire.
Primarily due to fires. What fires? These fires, which, as you can see, are fairly small and scattered throughout the building compared to the office fires I'm going to show you in a minute. But they're concentrated on just a few floors of the building. And let's go. And yet here we have the fires that are of particular question and focus by NIST. And they are on the 11th and 12th floor here on the east side and moving toward the west, as you can see across here. So by 3 p.m., well, we'll come back to the analysis there, but let's see what NIST's theory is here. They focus on the northeast section of the building here, and column 79 particularly, because it's under the east penthouse, which did fall first 6 seconds earlier than the overall building, as you saw. They also note some damage down in this area here on the south side. In fact, they note an awful lot of damage, but which is not visible in the photos or videos. But again, they point out that that's an insignificant factor. What was significant, they say, is the fires, which they highlight were on the south side, which is the side of the towers. Started presumably by the debris, which the beams which came out of the building, the North Tower, and they worked those fires worked around to the east side, and then they're hovering around column 79 for over an hour, apparently in this scenario, this fire simulation put forth by NIST. So even though they acknowledge that such fires didn't persist in any one location for more than about 20 or 30 minutes, well, that's what fire protection engineers around the world understand about the capacity of high-rise fires to burn for periods of time. 20 or 30 minutes is all the fuel there is to burn there. And in fact, the photographs show that the fires on the 12th floor were burned out before 4 o'clock, in fact. So this is in direct contradiction to the fire simulation that NIST provided. So we're going to show our own fire simulation as we see on the left, produced by excellent research of Chris Sarnes. And we have the fires burning and moving around to the east side, as the videos show, the photographs that are available show. And then by 3:50 p.m., those fires are moved halfway across over to the west. And they're actually burned out more than 20 minutes, before almost an hour, actually, in that whole area. But on the floor, more than 20 minutes, they're gone. Now, why is this important? Well, let's listen to the official cause of this building's collapse by these fires according to, once again, Shyam Sunder of NIST.
Our study has identified thermal expansion as a new phenomenon that can cause the collapse of a structure. For the first time, we have shown that fire can induce a progressive collapse. Our study has identified thermal expansion, and you can see on the screen the column at the very right is column 79, and that's the column that first buckles, causing the floors to come down, followed by a quick succession of failures of adjoining columns.
Okay, so there's a theory about what happened here. It's their only theory, and it goes like this. There were raging fires on this floor in this area around column 79 up until the collapse, and which we've already seen is a lie. Those fires expanded these long-span steel beams, pushing this girder off of its seat on this column 79. And that caused the floor 13 to fall on 12 and 12 on 11 and so on for nine floors when the whole thing has a progressive collapse and basically pancakes down. Now, that's the inside of the building, and then the outside of the building follows. None of this could be true for a whole variety of reasons, beginning with the fact that the fire was burnt out more than 20 minutes, so it couldn't be thermally expanding those beams at all. Also, those beams were fireproofed, as you can see, halfway through construction here. And so they're not going to be expanding because the fireproofing keeps them from getting hot enough to expand. NIST ignored the fireproofing in their computer model. But then they said these beams expanded and pushed this girder off of its seat. Well, that couldn't have happened because that girder is tied to the concrete slab up above with no less than 30 shear studs, which are pins with heads on them, 3/4 inches or so in diameter. And they are going to, that girder can't go anywhere. The shop drawings show that they're there. NIST omitted them too in order to favor the result that they were after. So also NIST ignored that girder could not have been pushed sideways by these beams off of its seat because it would have had to have been pushed off 12 inches because that's how long that seat is that beam is sitting on, as you can see blown up right here. Well, NIST says, no, it only had to be pushed halfway off of its seat because then once the vertical member, the web of this I-beam, if you will, or wide flange beam, clears the seat, the flange folded, the bottom piece folded. Well, that couldn't have happened at all because that bottom piece is supported by these, shown in red, 3/4 inch stiffeners. It's a thick steel plate welded here in plan, here in section. Elevation. And so they omit those structural stiffeners also from their analysis so they can get their favored result from their computer analysis. And this is what I mean by fraud. And if, let's just say that could have happened though, and this girder was pushed off of its seat on this column. Well, the floor 13 was supported by two other massive girders that you see over here. So how could that floor have even fallen far enough to hit the floor below, much less develop the required dynamic impact force to break the girder connections below that concrete slab? It would have taken 632,000 pounds of dynamic force to break the next floor down. And it only had a tenth of that if it were in full dynamic force, which it couldn't have been, as we mentioned. But let's say that could have happened and floor 13 falls on 12. Well, and so on for nine floors, leaving column 79 unbraced, at which point it begins to buckle. If that internal set of failures were happening, it would pull on the outside because these beams are connected all around the building to the exterior structure. So if they're pulling down, it would have crumpled the outside of the building. We would have seen a massive deformation on the exterior structural steel perimeter, causing incredible quantities of windows and granite panels to break and deform. We don't see any of that on the video, which we're going to continue to look at. And so then this says, well, then this internal cascading collapse starts at this east side and travels laterally across the building in less than 6 seconds. And this building is a football field in length, each floor an acre in size. So that's completely ludicrous to imagine that these structural steel connections could be giving way. Well, look at the computer model that NIST provides here.
Here is our structural model showing the building collapsing, which matches quite well with the video of the event.
What we're seeing is 400 structural steel connections failing on the left and nothing failing for the rest of the building because they didn't have the time and energy and memory capacity and computing capacity to finish it. But we can put the building side by side to their computer model and see if it matches quite well. Take a look on the left, the video of the building's collapse. The East penthouse is modeled accurately, but that's the only part. There is no massive breaking up of granite panels and windows. And in the computer model, it begins to tip over. And so they stop it at 2 seconds into the overall collapse. It doesn't look anything like the Building 7 videos. It's a complete charade. So we wrote to them and said, hey, we need to see your computer input data. It's got to be tested. This should be peer reviewed. This is part of 9/11. This is part of the destruction of the World Trade Center. This should be reviewed by every structural engineer in the country that has the capacity to do it. And there are a number of them. But they wrote a report that was 1,000 pages long and completely buffaloed the structural engineering industry with obfuscation and hidden opportunities to participate. They did not make that readily available in obvious ways. So we use the scientific method. How do we do that? We've had it in the West 100 years or so. And it's the way we winnow error from truth, fact from fiction, fantasy from reality. We have a question. How did this tower come down? We do background research. We make observations. We come up with a hypothesis or set of hypotheses without focusing on one that meets our own particular political or financial obligations, which would sway our objective opinion with regard to our conclusion about how the towers came down. Maybe they did come down by fire. That's something that needs to be looked at. Maybe it was explosions and controlled demolitions, which we'll be showing you a whole lot of evidence today for. So we test, we make predictions based on those hypotheses. We test them with experiments. We analyze the results. We draw conclusions. If the hypothesis is corroborated, we report the results in an open, transparent manner so all can build on the body of the work that we're doing. If the hypothesis is not corroborated, we go back and we construct a new hypothesis until we find one that is corroborated by the evidence, the experiments, and so forth. That's what we're about today. So let's do some background research. Let's find out what are the forces that act on buildings and possibly, maybe, might destroy them. Let's begin with fire. It's an organic and chaotic process. It burns out an area, as we mentioned, roughly 20 minutes or so. Then the fire moves on looking for fresh new fuel sources. And again, NIST even acknowledges that these fires didn't persist in any one location for more than about 20 or 30 minutes. So skyscrapers don't collapse, as we'll see, except on 9/11. But say in wood frame buildings, we'd have the structure itself, which is flammable, burns. And so the building can in that case, cave in on itself in phases. It's a chaotic process of obeying the laws of entropy with increasing disintegration. We don't have symmetrical collapses due to fire, for instance. Well, what would a fire do in a steel frame building? Jonathan Barnett of the FEMA team actually comments here, because this British steel company in Cardington built an 8-story building to see what would happen if we set incredible fires on it. And as you can see, there's incredible fuel loads in this building. They're trying to get these to be the hottest fires ever, possibly even up to 1,800 degrees. So they put fireproofing on some of these columns and beams, and some of them are not fireproofed. Worst case conditions, like NIST modeled, without fireproofing. Let's see what happened.
This was the largest test of its kind ever conducted. It showed how unprotected steel can be distorted, even by a normal office fire. But as is typical in steel buildings, the structural beams only slowly and progressively warped and sagged. There was no chance of a sudden collapse.
In over 20 years, I have not seen, until recently, a protected steel structure that has collapsed in a fire.
Except on 9/11, which is what he's talking about. So we have three protected steel structures collapse due to fire. Well, what did this test conclude? That it's inherently stable behavior due to the highly redundant nature of the structural steel form. This, the beams can warp at those temperatures, which is why we fireproof them, so that doesn't even happen. And the connections do not fail. That's the strongest part of the whole system. And yet that's the part that failed at a rate of 400 structural steel connections every second during the 7-second collapse of Building 7. So what about other skyscrapers? We've had dozens and dozens of fire, much larger, longer lasting, and hotter fires in these buildings, as you can see. Let's take a look.
May 4th, 1988, the First Interstate Bank, a 62-story building in Los Angeles, California, suffered a 3.5-hour fire which burned across 5 floors and caused an estimated $200 million of damage. It did not collapse. February 23rd, 1991, the One Meridian Plaza, a 38-story building in Philadelphia, suffered an 18-hour fire which burned across 8 floors. The fire caused an estimated $100 million worth of damage and 3 firefighters died fighting it. It was later described by officials as the most significant fire of the century. It did not collapse. October 17, 2004, the East Tower of the Park Central Complex in Caracas, Venezuela, suffered a 17-hour fire which spread across 26 of its 56 floors. It did not collapse. August 18th, 2007, a fire broke out on the 17th floor of the Deutsche Bank building in New York, a building undergoing deconstruction after being heavily damaged by debris from the South Tower on 9/11. Originally 41 stories in height, it had been reduced to 26 at the time of the fire, which lasted 7 hours and affected a total of 10 floors. Two firefighters died of smoke inhalation. It did not collapse. On 9/11 itself, 5 World Trade Center, a 9-story building east of the North Tower, was engulfed in flames after sustaining heavy damage from falling debris. A number of partial collapses occurred, but the overall structure remained standing. February 9, 2009, the Mandarin Oriental Hotel in Beijing was completely engulfed in flames for more than 3 hours during the Lunar New Year celebrations. The fire affected all 44 floors, igniting fireworks as it burned. One firefighter died fighting it. It did not collapse.
No, and neither did these skyscrapers, which are fully engulfed in fire after 9/11, and they didn't collapse. But on 9/11, we have 3 protected steel skyscrapers, fire protected, that collapsed. This should be the most backed up by the most extraordinary body of evidence ever. And as we have already seen, it is a charade. Now let's look at buildings that have exploded, because we're going to be, that's one of the hypotheses, that Building 7 and next week the Twin Towers exploded. So let's examine this. I mean, we have thick, billowing, enormous pyroclastic-like clouds in buildings that are exploded with pulverized concrete. We have gases that are expanding rapidly in cauliflower-shaped forms. And due to the incredible heat produced from the chemical ignition of the gases, we have sounds of explosions that are heard by witnesses, flashes of light that are seen by them. So let's examine what controlled demolitions do, because here's where we take explosions and we harness them very effectively and efficiently, place them at the columns and beams of the building, and this is what we get. A uniform, straight down, symmetrical, often very rapid descent, because the structure is removed by the explosives. So the building can fall almost as fast as a bowling ball falling out of the sky. There's only a handful of companies in around the world that can accomplish this. This is not something that fire does to protected steel structures like this, or in this case, some of these are concrete. But either way, so there's a set of features that we can associate with controlled demolition. What are they? Well, we have a sudden onset of destruction, usually at the base of the structure. And we have a straight down or nearly straight down, if that's what they want, or if they want it to go to one side, they can do that too. But often it's symmetrical collapse into the building's own footprint, because patterned support, there's a patterned removal of those structural steel columns. That's how that happens. And it happens fast at accelerating, you often free fall accelerating, as we'll see in the case of Building 7, through the path of what was the greatest resistance, the thousands of tons of structural steel that was supporting the building. But that has been dismembered, and often in pieces that are suitable to be loaded onto the trucks and carried away from the aftermath of the building. Well, of course, we want limited damage to adjacent structures. That's one of the goals of controlled demolition. And patterned explosions are heard by witnesses. They're felt by witnesses often. Their flashes of light are seen by witnesses. The concrete is broken up. They want to do that with explosives rather than go in there and jackhammer floors that are damaged but at all odd angles. Very dangerous work for somebody operating a heavy piece of equipment like that. Let the explosives do that work. So there's explosive charges that are visible often and there are obviously explosions. And there's chemical evidence of those charges left behind in the residue. If we have these features, we know we have direct evidence of explosive destruction. Fire doesn't create these features, any of them, let alone all of them. Fires cause structures to collapse asymmetrically with gradual deformation following the path of least resistance. So with additional circumstantial corroborative testimony like government documentation of foreknowledge of the destruction, people know in advance when a building's going to be brought down. Often they promote it to publicize themselves. It becomes a community event. Not in this case. Experts agree, hey, that's a controlled demolition. Well, at least those experts without financial or political obligations that would sway their objective opinion in the matter of whether it was or was not a controlled demolition. The controlled demolition industry in this country and probably most around the world receive most of their work from federal contracts. So they're not about to support a theory of controlled demolition, which would put their entire business at stake. But with these features, we have proof, or we can apply this model to find out whether something was a controlled demolition. Something like World Trade Center 7, for instance. So let's do that. Let's start. Is there a sudden onset of destruction at the base of the structure? Let's listen to Dan Rather as he explains his view of this building's collapse.
You're seeing are high shots. Now, here we're going to show you a videotape of the collapse itself.
Describe that.
Now we go to videotape the collapse of this building.
It's amazing.
Amazing, incredible, pick your word. For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
What? Destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down? Well, Dan's using his intuition here, as we all should be, rather than just swallowing what we are told. So, hook, line, and sinker. But he never repeated this again after 9/11. In fact, with the exception of maybe two times on mainstream media, we have not seen Building 7 come down. So, which is one of the reasons most of the architects and engineers, for instance, in the American Institute of Architects, 90,000 members, of which I'm one, did not receive any notice or bulletin from the headquarters there, the association, about the third worst structural failure in modern history. Not a peep. Just a simple endorsement later on of the NIST report when we tried to bring it, all this evidence, to the attention of the leadership of the American Institute of Architects and in their public meeting several times. Do we have a straight down symmetrical collapse into the building's footprint? Well, let's look from West Street. Pretty straight down, pretty symmetrical. Okay. Notice here, by the way, the East Penthouse has already come down on the left. Now what's happening is the West Penthouse and the screen wall, you can see drop a half a second prior to the overall collapse of this building. Indicating what? That the supports underneath them, the columns, gave way all at once. Well, wait, that's not the theory that NIST put out. They said that this started on the east side and then traveled laterally from left to right in this view in 6 seconds. But no, this reveals that the core structure collapsed all at once, a half a second prior to the overall, indicating that those columns had to have been removed all at once. Well, does fire do that? Does fire allow that then to that that symmetricality to be visible in a complete collapse into its own footprint. The center of the pile is in the center of the building's footprint. The tallest controlled demolition, the demolition of the tallest building in history, by the way, very successful, except the Twin Towers, which we will get to next week. Let's take a look. Let's put Building 7 on the left, a series of controlled demolitions on the right. Is there any similarity? Is there enough similarity to warrant an investigation into the possible use of explosives? Especially since it looks exactly like a controlled demolition. Especially since fire, the official cause of this building's collapse, has never brought down a steel frame skyscraper ever in history. Fire protected steel frame skyscraper. There's partial collapses of non-fire protected steel frame. So this should have been the obvious hypothesis, the first hypothesis looked at by NIST, since it's the most obvious conclusion. But what have they done? They relegated it to a series of very frequently asked questions 10 years later on their website. Did investigators consider the possibility that an explosion caused or contributed to the collapse of World Trade Center 7? NIST concluded that blast events inside the building did not occur and found no evidence supporting the existence of a blast event. Well, guess what? We're going to be showing you all kinds of evidence, which they had access to even back then. So we have that complete symmetrical collapse caused by these fires. As Joe Biden says, come on, man. I couldn't resist. Is there a pattern removal of column supports? Well, how do you bring a building down symmetrically? You have to remove all 80 columns within a second of each other. Any deviation in that pattern, the building would obviously begin to tip over. And that's been proven by the University of Alaska, which we'll show you. So, does fire have that level of precision? These fires. This is a very important question because, as you can imagine, the implications of the controlled demolition of Building 7 are enormous. It casts doubt across the whole set of events at the World Trade Center and beyond. Is there a free fall acceleration? And what does that mean? Let's go to physics teacher David Chandler. How fast is this building coming down?
Just by watching it, anybody can see that Building 7 fell close to free fall. To measure it, I use software to track the corner of the building and compute a graph of downward velocity as a function of time. The graph had a long, straight section indicating constant acceleration. Measuring the slope, I found the acceleration to be within 1% of the acceleration of gravity for the first 2.5 seconds. In other words, the building fell through its own structure with zero resistance.
Zero resistance for a third of this building's 7-second fall? Meaning not one column gave any resistance to the collapse during that time?
This building had 40,000 tons of structural steel in its structural system, and that is intended to keep it from going anywhere.
NIST is telling us that the building below it ceased to exist for the first few seconds of the collapse of the building. Well, things in physics just don't cease to exist and cease to resist the forces that are on them. The building didn't disappear so the building can fall for 100 feet at free fall speed. That's impossible. That's a violation of the fundamental law of physics that says that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Even if the columns buckled, all of them, they would still provide a minimum of 25% of their capacity under these significant loads. They don't just disappear. That is something every structural engineer understands. Now, NIST, after publicly denying that this building came down at free fall acceleration, they were forced into admitting it publicly by members of AE 911 Truth, like Stephen Jones and David Chandler and others, who challenged them publicly. So they had no choice. They had to turn around and admit that in their final report that it came down at free fall. Because they said earlier, if it came down at free fall, that would mean there'd be no structure. Duh. So they do not acknowledge the implications of that free fall, meaning there would be no structure, or where did the structure go? Is the building dismembered? Yeah. A 47-story, moment-resisting steel frame skyscraper where the columns and the beams are rigidly welded. So this does not happen, or that can happen, but this does not happen. So we have a complete failure of virtually all the column-to-beam connections in the building. It falls like a house of cards. And that's what you see in the pile. Is there limited damage to adjacent structures? One of the goals of controlled demolition? Well, there's some damage. Some pieces of this building hit, but the center of the building is in the center of the center of the piles in the center of the footprint. So fairly minimal damage compared to what could have happened if the building tipped over, right? Are there sounds of explosions that are heard by witnesses? Let's first listen to Shyam Sunder of NIST.
We did not find any evidence that explosives were used in the collapse of Building 7. We ran down detailed computer simulations of blast scenarios. This size blast would have produced an incredibly loud sound that was not recorded on videos of the collapse, nor reported by witnesses.
Well, there are blasts that are recorded by witnesses. I'm going to show you some. But this statement infers that we're talking about high-energy explosives, but we're going to be showing you a new technology today that was more likely the cause of the severing of the steel. A relatively new technology in terms of controlled demolitions. Anyway, so let's listen to Kevin. Let's listen to this gentleman, a medical student.
We were watching the building actually because it was on fire. The bottom floors of the building were on fire, and we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, we were shocked to see that the building was it looked like there was a shock wave ripping through the building, and the windows all bumped it out, and it was horrifying. And then, about a second later, the bottom floor caved out, and the building followed after that. And
well, a sound of a clap of thunder, a shock wave ripping through the building, windows busting out, and then the building coming down. How about this gentleman, Kevin McPadden, former Air Force medic?
And then it was like another 2-3 seconds. You heard explosions, like boom. It's like a distinct sound. It's not like when in compression, like boom, 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 like floors that were dropping and collapsing. This was boom, and like you felt a rumble in the ground, like almost like you wanted to grab onto something. That, to me, I knew that was an explosion. There was no doubt in my mind.
And this gentleman near Building 7 also.
I'm going to call in Bill Rosati. He was here when it all happened. He saw it for himself. Bill, if you can just tell us what you saw, what you heard.
I was standing like two blocks away, and all of a sudden I just seen a big flash, and then I seen the building coming down, and I just seen people just running everywhere, chaotic-like.
And this gentleman, Barry Jennings, who, along with Mayor Giuliani's attorney, Michael Hess, went back into the building, not realizing, and this is in the late morning, before the towers came down, but after they were hit by the airplanes, they're showing up for duty because on the 23rd floor was this emergency operations center designed to facilitate managing the city in the event of an incredible emergency like this. So they didn't realize that the building had been evacuated just before they got there. This is their experience.
When we got to the 8th floor, I started walking to one side of the building. That side of the building was gone. The first explosion I heard when I was on the stairwell landing, when we made it down to the 6th floor. Then we made it back to the 8th floor, I heard some more explosions.
What's the sound?
Like a boom. Like an explosion.
More than one?
Yes. We started walking down the stairs. We made it to the 8th floor. Big explosion. Blew us back into the 8th floor. When we get outside, a police officer comes to me and says, you have to run. We have more information of bombs, so you have to run. What?
Information of bombs? Bombs like this one heard in the late morning of 9/11 nearby Building 7?
Yeah, here's one of the guys. He can tell you I'm okay, all right? Here, hold on. You want to call your mother or something?
This is well after the Twin Towers went down, as you can see by the debris on the all over the pavement and the road. NIST doesn't acknowledge any explosions at Building 7. And hardly any at the Twin Towers, which we'll get to next week. But the seismic event center, Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, recorded a 0.6 magnitude event near the time of the collapse, which is attributed to the collapse by the official narrative. But let's look into it a little deeper, because the event occurs at 5:20 and 42 seconds in the afternoon. There's the peak seismic signal. And yet the start of the collapse doesn't happen for another 10 seconds. So how can the collapse cause the event, seismic event, 10 seconds earlier? Well, NIST has an answer for this. A seismic signal approximately 10 seconds prior to the onset of collapse was likely due to the falling of debris from inside the building. Wait a minute. Oh, that video is supposed to play for you, and it is not. Now it is. So the East Penthouse comes down, and there's nothing indicating that it's anything's collapsing below it. And then 6 seconds later, oh, did that stop? It stopped again. This happens. As you saw, the West Penthouse and screen wall, 6 seconds after that East Penthouse, all fall at once, just half a second. Not 10 seconds prior to the overall collapse of the building. So how can the interior collapse, they claim, cause those signals? That makes no sense whatsoever. André Rousseau, an applied geophysics expert, author of more than 50 published papers on progressive mechanical waves and geology, has an answer, though. He looks at the seismic data and he says the bell-like form points to an impulsive source of energy. Not percussion on the ground due to falling of debris. Seismic waves are only created by brief impulses, low frequencies. These undeniably have an explosive origin. Okay, well, that makes sense. Do we have pyroclastic-like clouds of pulverized concrete? This is an incredible body of evidence because the National Fire Protection Association 921, the Guide for Fire and Explosion Investigations, it says, look for large volumes of gas and a large amount of heat released in chemical explosions, causing rapidly expanding plumes of hot gases. Well, did NIST do that? Because such plumes were observable directly after the final destruction, racing away from the Building 7's collapse in every direction, 35 miles an hour, expanding cauliflower-shaped plumes of incredible heat are occurring here. And this is what you want to be looking for. Now, there's not much heat in this building. In fact, the heat in these fires that were remaining, and these were gone by 5 o'clock, but maybe there were a few small fires somewhere else. Probably not, but they would have been extinguished by the mechanical action of the collapse of the building if they were there. So we're looking for a whole lot more heat that can cause that rapid expanding plumes. Something on the order of this. And we find it. Let's look first at the NASA Air Flights, infrared sensitive camera, thermal mapping, documenting surface temperatures on the surface of the aftermath of Building 7 of 1,340 degrees from this U.S. geological aerial photo. There's no fire on the surface. So 1,340 degrees Fahrenheit, where is that heat coming from? Because they're mapping the surface. It's coming from deep down in the pile. Which surely was much hotter, and we'll show you evidence to that effect, than 1,340 degrees Fahrenheit. But it's cooling off as it gets to the surface down to 1,340 degrees. That's what they're measuring. Let's look at some evidence of this heat. First, Abulhazen Astani Azal, the first structural engineer given access to the World Trade Center steel in a National Science Foundation grant.
I saw melting of girders in World Trade Center.
Wait a minute. You what? You saw the melting of girders and you documented this very piece of steel? And it's melted? And it's from World Trade Center 7? And you don't wonder how that piece of steel was so deeply corroded and melted and partly evaporated? No, some people are just too smart for their own good or anybody else's good. Even the FEMA author Jonathan Barnett says steel members in the debris pile appear to have been partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures. Well, that doesn't happen with normal office fires, which is all we have in Building 7. Remember, it was not hit by a plane, no jet fuel. And jet fuel itself, according to its manufacturer, by the way, ME Petroleum, only burns at 600 degrees Fahrenheit in open air. So we have a huge problem. It takes 4,000 degrees to evaporate steel. Where's that temperature coming from? In fact, it's documented the evaporation of steel in the hot sulfur corrosion attack in Appendix C of FEMA's Building Performance Assessment Team report that came out in May of 2002. An incredible metallurgical examination. What do they find? The results are striking. A phenomenon never before observed in building fires. Eutectic reactions causing intergranular melting capable of turning a solid steel girder into Swiss cheese, like you see here in this piece of World Trade Center 7 steel. Rapid oxidation and sulfidation in this severe high-temperature corrosion attack on the steel. Liquid iron. What's that? That's molten iron. Takes 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit to begin to melt steel. Office fires are only a quarter or so of that typically. Sulfur formed during this hot corrosion attack on the steel, so well documented early on by FEMA in their report, which the New York Times said this is perhaps the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation. But didn't NIST carry this information over into their new report when they took over in 2002? And produced their own report, which came out in 2008, 7 years after 9/11, when hopefully nobody would remember about Building 7 if they ever knew about it in the first place. And what does NIST say about this phenomena? Well, did they test the steel? No, we couldn't test the steel. We didn't have any steel. No steel was recovered. Again and again and again, they make this claim. But we just saw the tests of the steel done by FEMA before them. No metallography could be carried out. But here's the co-project leader, John Gross, on the pile, examining the very piece of steel that was turned to Swiss cheese and provided to FEMA for documentation. And yet he claims there is nothing to it, but his shadow is all over the evidence. Well, how hot were these fires? Some claim 1,200 degrees, Thomas Iger. Even jet fuel, as I mentioned, burned 600 degrees. Some office contents burned hotter than that, maybe 1,400 degrees. That is far less than half of what's required to melt steel. Well, 14 is about half. But steel had definitely melted. Now, this is the point that the debunkers and the official narrative and phony journalists like Jeremy Stahl from Slate Magazine point to. They said it didn't have to melt to bend the steel. Well, duh. But it did melt. And there's lots of proof of steel melting, dripping out of the material held in the crab claw excavator. We can tell, because of the physics of molten metals, how hot it is by its color. We're exceeding 2,500 degrees in this bright yellow and white hot liquid. So what caused the steel to melt? Is it possible that thermite is a possibility? Well, let's examine that and see. This is the scientific method. We don't have a biased outcome here. We're looking at the evidence and seeing where it leads. What is thermite, anyway?
An incendiary used by the military, thermite is a compound of iron oxide and aluminum, which, when ignited, sustains an extreme heat reaction, creating molten iron. In just 2 seconds, thermite can reach temperatures over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, quite enough to liquefy steel. We know that open-air fires cannot burn hot enough to melt steel, but metal had melted at the base of the towers. Appendix C of the FEMA report describes sulfur residues on the World Trade Center steel. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery of all. Sulfur slightly lowers the melting point of iron, and iron oxide and iron sulfide had formed on the surface of the structural steel. Sulfur used with thermite is called thermate, producing even faster results.
Well, maybe we're getting somewhere here, because if thermite were used, it would explain the presence of this extreme heat. It produces 4,000 degrees. It would explain the presence of liquid molten iron also, not steel, elemental iron, the byproduct of thermite. We haven't used iron in our skyscrapers for 100 years or so. This is elemental iron, as we'll point out to you in a few minutes. It would also explain the presence of sulfur. Sulfur is added to thermite to become thermate. Even more capable of cutting through steel much more efficiently. So that is very interesting. Was NFPA 921 followed, which says, look for unusual residues which could arise from thermite or other pyrotechnic materials. Did NIST follow the set of documents that they, in fact, helped to put together? Yes, NIST was involved in the National Fire Protection Association guides. No, they didn't follow it, by the way. In fact, they said they found no corroborating evidence to suggest that explosives were used. Well, wait a minute. A year later, they finally admit NIST did not test for the presence of explosive residue. You'll never find what you will not look for. Others did. Stephen Jones, a nuclear physicist, formerly from Brigham Young University, was one of those. He looked for evidence in the steel sent to him by the sculptor of the International Peace Park in Manitoba. He first noticed, gosh, this is not a nice straight line. This is quite a jagged line. Is this what the oxyacetylene and thermal lances do when they cut steel? No, they do this. They're very clean, very hot, very efficient. They don't do this. So what's doing this? And what's doing that? Well, a piece of this slag was examined by Professor Jones, and what does he find? Elements of manganese, which we'll get to in a moment too, iron, and sulfur. So the iron, Fe, and sulfur, and aluminum indicate thermate, because sulfur is added to thermite to become thermate. And we'll get to the manganese in a moment too. Now, is there evidence for molten iron other than that throughout all the World Trade Center dust samples? Well, the U.S. Geological Survey does detailed studies on the powder, and in 2005, they produced their particle atlas of the World Trade Center dust. What do they find? Billions of these. What are they? Previously molten iron microspheres. Wait a minute. They're previously molten. They're elemental iron, and they're in spherical shapes. Let's break this down. First of all, how many of these are there? There's 6% in some of the samples. 6% of that World Trade Center dust, hundreds and hundreds of tons of it throughout lower Manhattan. It amounts to about 4 tons by extrapolation. This is not background iron components in dust, which can be there, and they look like this. They're not spherical like that. RJ Lee Group also doing analysis finds that these were formed during the event, producing spherical metallic particles. They don't know what they are. They don't know where they came from, or they don't say. They're used as a signature component to distinguish World Trade Center dust from common office building dust, these previously molten iron microspheres. What? How did that happen? And how do my slides get all sideways on me? I'll fix that before next time. Let's do an experiment with thermite. Ignite it. It looks like thousands of sparks, slowing it down halfway here. They're not sparks, though. They're molten iron. And how do they get to be spherical? Because the molten iron is a byproduct of thermite. Well, spheres are the byproduct of aerosolized liquids. If you sneeze or spray a spray bottle, those become spherical. That's just because of the surface tension of liquids. Hot liquids, in this case. Falling where? On the cars around World Trade Center, producing toasting of the tops of these cars. Is there any other rational cause for the toasting of the tops of cars parked in and around the World Trade Center in this very hot event that some others describe as a cold event? Well, you can make thermite-based cutter charges, shaped cutter charges, in your own backyard, like civil engineer John Cole did, and this is what happens if you do a decent job. And in this case, cutting just about cleanly through a steel connection that he succeeded at. But there are much more efficient devices out there for this purpose, using thermite to cut through much thicker sections of steel with greater efficiency than high-energy explosives like C4 and RDX. Why would they not have wanted to use those? Well, they provide very loud bangs, as Sham Sunder exclaimed, and very bright flashes, which would give away the what's really going on in what's supposed to be a deceptive, controlled demolition. But what about all of the casings of these shaped cutter charges left behind? Well, guess what? The casings can be made of consumable consolidated thermite. So it too burns up and there's nothing left except molten iron, which we're going to be looking at a lot of evidence for too. So more interestingly, what else was found in the World Trade Center dust? Any residue of unignited thermite? What we've seen so far is evidence of ignited thermite. Well, a small team of scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen examined seven different samples of the dust, like the dust from this apartment from Jeanette McKinley, who provided one of the samples. Her apartment was right across the street from the South Tower, and all of those apartments, the windows blew in and the dust filled their apartment. It was extremely traumatic, full of asbestos and other toxins. It was a horrible situation for everybody. She ended up actually dying of brain cancer because she worked with this dust in her artwork. It was her form of therapy. Very, very tragic. Friend of mine from the Bay Area. Now, they find red-gray chips. They thought they were paint in the dust samples. They look like primer paint, right? The largest one's about a 16th of an inch long. And the red layer is very curious because they do X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy and they find iron and aluminum, the key ingredients of thermite, in the paint chips. Well, they're not paint chips then, right? They get real curious. They zoom in 50,000 times and what do they find? Nano-sized particles of iron oxide and aluminum powder, the ingredients of thermite. They're 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. These are nano-engineered particles. They're set in a matrix of organic material, oxygen, silica, carbon. Organic material is what gives the incredible power to TNT. When it ignites, it produces this increase of gas exponentially, which knocks things over. That's what explosives do. Whereas incendiaries, which is what thermite is, destroys by means of heat. Well, there's they, according to the peer-reviewed literature, these chips, four of them, all ignite at about 420 degrees centigrade, 758 Fahrenheit. And just like the peer-reviewed literature of super thermite produced by Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, what happens when they ignite? They produce what? Molten iron microspheres with the same chemical signature as the molten iron microspheres that were studied by the U.S. Geological Survey and R.J. Lee at the World Trade Center. So we know where these molten iron microspheres came from. They came from these red-gray chips. So we have a set of repeatable, experimentally reproducible data that can be used in a court of law to put a lot of people away for the crimes of mass murder and treason. And we've got this evidence in the legal system in several different ways, which I'll explain to you later. So that's going to be a really important set of outcomes. As if we didn't know where these spheres came from, they're found attached to partially ignited red-gray chips, as you see here and here. So this is an extremely sophisticated process. When you get the size of these particles down like this, it exponentially increases the surface area. So the chemical reactions are virtually instantaneous. So you have an incendiary which has become engineered to become more explosive. We don't know how explosive. We do know this is not made in a cave in Afghanistan. It's made only in the most advanced defense contracting laboratories. So if there's ever an independent grand jury investigation, it's not going to be too difficult to figure out how and where this stuff is made and by whom. The scientific team concludes that the red layer is unreacted thermitic material incorporating nanotechnology. It's a highly energetic pyrotechnic material. This is documented in a peer-reviewed paper, the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal, 24 pages. It stands uncontested. Nobody submitted their peer-reviewed paper to contest the results of it. That's what you would do if you had the scientific capability to challenge it like that. Yeah, people say, oh, this is just paint. Paint does not have these exotic properties. So what we've been able to show so far is features 1 through 10 of explosive controlled demolition, in this case with incendiaries, in the case of Building 7. This is direct evidence of destruction with incendiaries. No evidence of destruction from fires. Fire doesn't create any of these features, let alone all of them, which is what would be needed to be proven in order to debunk the evidence that we're talking about today. Why can't fire bring down buildings that are steel frame buildings that are fireproofed? Well, we have one reason: steel conducts that heat away from the source very rapidly. It's very dense. So the steel never gets to its 1200 degree Fahrenheit temperature, at which it's a critical temperature, because it can lose half of its strength and begin to sag. We don't want that to happen. So we put fireproofing on all of our steel, critical steel components of steel frame buildings. Keeping that steel from getting hot enough to fail for 2 hours on the beams and 3 hours on the columns, that's a lot more time than 20 minutes, which is all the time fire has in a given area, as we talked about. So that's 4 to 6 times more fire protection than we would ever need. But just to keep that from happening, we make sure the contractors don't build skyscrapers out of combustible materials. And we make sure that the tenants don't bring in huge fuel loads. It's very highly regulated what you can bring in terms of furnishings and finishes and so forth. So, and to make sure that just is not a problem at all, we put fire sprinklers in all of our skyscrapers these days. So what about the investigations? We have, in 2002, as I mentioned, FEMA, they had $600,000 worth of funding, but their efforts were quite hampered to get to the truth. They couldn't get access to the blueprints of the building, couldn't get adequate access to the site. They couldn't appeal to the public to get photographs and so forth, and other crucial information. NIST takes over the investigation, as we mentioned, throws out the metallurgical examination that was so revealing, and produces a report in 2008 that started with the stated conclusion that fires caused the collapse. They weren't looking at what caused the collapse, even though they were tasked by Congress to determine what caused the collapse. They did not do that. And the fraudulent efforts they had were just exposed. And they acknowledged, truthfully, we've had trouble getting a handle on Building 7. Yeah, you did. So after tossing the most critical evidence in the whole FEMA report, FEMA having acknowledged further research, investigation, and analysis are needed to resolve the issue of how the building came down. Unfortunately, though, for those hoping to resolve the issue, we have one of the largest mass removals of evidence in the largest and most perplexing structural failures in history. 400 truckloads a day hauled from the scene of the crime. This is the illegal destruction of evidence in a crime scene. But it was labeled a terrorist attack, so they weren't bound by the laws of preservation of evidence in a crime scene, prompting Bill Manning, editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering magazine, to cry out, "Crucial evidence that could answer many questions is on the slow boat to China, showing an astounding ignorance of government officials to the value of a thorough scientific investigation. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately." But it didn't, prompting experts like Danny Jawinko to speak out publicly.
Danny Jawenko is the expert on this in Europe. What did he say?
Dit is controlled demolition. Zeker weten. Zeker weten. Er is nagesprongen. Dit is in opdracht gebeurd. Het heeft een team gedaan van experts.
No doubt whatsoever. And Hugo Bachmann, chairman of the Department of Structural Dynamics and Earthquake Engineering, in my opinion, World Trade Center 7 was with great probability professionally demolished. And Kamal Obaid, one of 100 structural engineers over at AE 9/11 Truth, architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, a localized failure in a steel-framed building like World Trade Center 7 cannot cause a catastrophic collapse like a house of cards without a simultaneous and patterned loss of several of its columns at key locations within the building. Does that sound like something fire can do? The University of Alaska was contracted by AE 9/11 Truth to conduct a four-year, $300,000 study as to what really happened at Building 7. And they did the study that NIST failed to do. They noted the problem. No other tall steel frame building had ever failed due to fire. We have to ensure that the public safety, for the public safety, that the failure mechanism of this structure be understood. So they first examine the response to the fire loads. I mean, what does the building do when it gets hot? Rule out scenarios that would not cause the collapse, and then identify the types of failures and locations that could have contributed to the observable collapse. They use the same input data as NIST, so that which was publicly available. And they're comparing apples to apples here, even though much of that input data was found to be false or falsified. They wanted to compare apples to apples and say, let's see if the same thing happens. So they're going to simulate the local structural responses for fire loading on floors 13 and below, where NIST focused, examine the NIST collapse initiation hypothesis, and then simulate numerous failure scenarios to identify what would lead to the total collapse as observed on 9/11. So they put all the information into AutoCAD, and they use two separate modeling programs, Abacus and SAP 2000. And they do a number of detailed models exposing fraud on the part of NIST, which we've already gone into, omitting shear studs, omitting stiffeners, omitting the incapacity of floor 13 to break the connections, holding floor 12 up below, even with a dynamic load, finding that the whole movement inside the building went the opposite way because the end wall was not infinitely stiff, as NIST claimed, which caused them to get their girder to be pushed off of its seat. So these are the findings. NIST overestimated the exterior wall rigidity. They were flexible. The movements were from west to east. The floor and the beams are moving the opposite direction, even. Girder A2001 off of its seat was in the opposite direction and was not an issue. Shear connections on several beams were broken, according to NIST, but this is not valid. In SAP 2000, they find that columns 79, 80, and 81 did not even fail. And if they could fail, the building would have tipped over, something like this. So if you model NIST's, and that's what their computer model actually did, if you recall back then, it began to tip over. So they stopped it after 2 seconds, right about here. Fascinating exposure of NIST here. The collapse of Building 7 was a global failure, not a progressive collapse, as claimed by NIST, involving the sequential failure of columns, but a global failure, meaning all the columns had to have been removed within a second or so of each other in order for the building to fall the way it did in the videos. They say fire did not cause the collapse of World Trade Center 7. The temperatures were not high enough to cause the weakening of the steel framing. Thermal expansion did not result in the loss of support for the beams and the girders, and Building 7 did not experience a progressive collapse, but a global collapse caused by the near simultaneous failure of its columns, all of them. So when you compare the models, the Halsey study, Professor Leroy Halsey at the University of Alaska on the left, the video of the building's collapse in the middle, and NIST's collapse, which stops 2 seconds after the overall collapse right there, what begins to resemble the actual cause of the actual collapse, appearance of the collapse of the building? It's the Alaska study. Okay, well, did people know? If this was a controlled demolition, people would have knew about it, right? Is there any foreknowledge of the collapse of this building? Well, this is very interesting. Chief Hayden says, could we anticipate a collapse if we allowed it to burn? And how soon? Well, this engineer says, they say he was pretty much right on the money. In its current state, you have about 5 hours. Wait a minute. You have an engineer announcing the collapse of a building that has a few small office fires, noting that even skyscrapers that have fully engulfed fires do not collapse ever. And yet he announced, and sure enough, it comes down 5 hours later. We call that foreknowledge. That can only happen either with two reasons. One, you're psychic and very good. And or two, you know darn well that building's coming down for other means. How about these mysterious construction workers walking away from Building 7, hearing an explosion over their shoulder, looking back into the CNN camera and saying, "Oh,
you hear that?
If you're in that building, it'll be coming down.
The building is about to blow up. Move it back.
All right, guys.
We are looking back. It's a building about to blow up. On flame. Debris coming down.
What? The building is about to blow up? Flame and debris coming down? How do they know the building is about to blow up? They must have heard. They must have been involved. They're, it's a late afternoon. They're walking back away from Building 7. So they must have... They must be on the inside here. So what does Kevin McPadden say before he witnessed the explosions, which we heard from him about earlier? He and others have walked back. They've been moved back away from Building 7, held back behind the yellow tape. He's listening to a radio held in the hands of a Red Cross worker. And this is what he hears.
At the last few seconds, he took his hand off, and you heard 3, 2, 1.
And then the explosions he talked about. Do fires bring buildings down to countdowns? What's really going on here? And how did the BBC announce the collapse of this building 20 minutes before it even happened?
Now, more on the latest building collapse in New York. You might have heard a few moments ago, I was talking about the Salomon Brothers building collapsing. And indeed it has. Apparently that's only a few hundred yards away from where the World Trade Center towers were. And it seems that this was not a result of a new attack. It was because the building had been weakened during this morning's attacks. We'll probably find out more now about that from our correspondent, Jane Stanley. Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy.
Sketchy indeed. They apologize for this error, citing the confusing events of the day. What, does this make them psychic? What's really going on here? And how did CNN announce the collapse of this building at 11:07. 7 hours. 6 hours before it actually collapsed.
In New York, Alan Dodds Frank joins us on the phone in Lower Manhattan. Alan?
Alan, just two or three minutes ago, there was yet another collapse or explosion. I'm now out of sight. A Good Samaritan has taken me in on Duane Street. But at 10:45, there was another collapse or explosion following the 10:30 collapse of the second tower. And a firefighter who rushed by us estimated that 50 stories went down. The street filled with smoke. It was like a fire, forest fire roaring down a canyon. Now, as I think Patty Sabgen and others have told you, all of Manhattan is covered, downtown Manhattan is covered with thick white ash and building material.
Yeah. This is incredible, because if Building 7 did come down when they said it came down, I mean, and where did they get that information? There's no other 50-story building that went down. There's no other building that collapsed. There were some partially damaged buildings. But they're nowhere near the description of what he's describing here. That would have been incredible, because we would not have any videos of Building 7 if it came down at that time, because it would have been completely obscured by the massive dust cloud released when the Twin Towers came down. So a lot of people speculate that it was supposed to go down at that time under the cover of the massive quantity of dust, so that it could just be attributed to being destroyed by the other buildings. Wow, we're speculating, though. Let's listen to Larry Silverstein and see what you think he means when he says this in October of 2002, a year later.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull. And then we watched the building collapse.
What? Firefighters don't pull buildings. Pull it is a term used in the controlled demolition industry. And you don't. And he apologized for this utterance, suggesting that I meant pull the firemen out of the building. Well, guess what? The firefighters made the decision early on not to attempt to fight the fires. They were not in the building fighting the fires. Early on, they allowed it to burn. FEMA said there's no firefighting operations. So he can't be talking about the firefighters. Anyway, what does the scientific method reveal to you? What caused Building 7 to collapse? Is it fire or controlled demolition? Have we shown 10 key characteristics and some very uncharacteristic features of controlled demolition today? Is that direct evidence to you of destruction with explosives? Is there evidence of fire? No. Fire can't create any one of these features, let alone all of them, with additional circumstantial corroborative information and evidence. To so many architects, engineers, and millions throughout the 9/11 truth movement, and people are becoming aware, agree, yeah, this is a controlled demolition. So we have a real problem. And so we would take your questions and answers, but I need to get myself a volunteer who can do that first. So we're not going to be doing that today. And I want to encourage you, though, to sign up for our email at AE. Excuse me. That's where I was. That's funny. You know, I have a hard time re-identifying myself, redefining myself, reinventing myself. I founded AE 911 Truth 15 years ago. I grew it into an organization with a whole lot of great help over there. And now our company name here, our organization, is Richard Gage AIA Architect. So I'll be holding on to it a little tighter this time, and encourage you to sign up for my list. I have about 400 or 500 so far, and it's growing slowly. But be sure to sign up and subscribe if you haven't already, and get informed. We have lots of evidence on the website at richardgage911.org. And there are brochures that were made over at AE 911 Truth, of which I'm not affiliated anymore. But these are great brochures with incredible informative content that I use for my radio interviews and as an outline for my speeches, speaking events that I give. We have a great little brochure designed by, written by Andy Steele and designed by Larry Landon. 9/11 Truth, Good for America, all the reasons that this is just so important for us, that we get to the real truth about what happened. Because, again, if these are controlled demolitions, then the implications are absolutely astounding. And next week and the week after, we'll show you the evidence for the Twin Towers at 1 o'clock on Thursday. But the detailed outline of evidence is right here in your hands. You can go over to AE 911 Truth and purchase these 100 of them for $10 or so. Here at richardgage911.org, you can see the best videos that we've produced in terms of the documentaries. It's all right here, right on the website. And the best presentations that I've given, and others have given too. The best interviews and some mainstream TV interviews too, and really, really good stuff that we've developed over the last 15 years, and the street activism that we've done all over the country and around the world. Really important work that local people are engaged in the 9/11 truth movement. And I join them wherever I travel to get the word out, and we inspire each other. Do sign the petition over at AE 9/11 Truth. They have 3,500 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation. They have 20 or 30,000 others supporting them. So you don't have to be an architect or engineer. And support them with donations as well. That website is ae911truth.org. And support yours truly, because I am starting over. It's a humble beginning, trust me. We don't know if we're going to be able to succeed financially. So please support us. You can make a one-time donation on the website with PayPal. You can also become a sustaining supporter with a subscription plan for $7 a month. That is really helpful. The founding members at $300 per year will join us in our monthly call, which we're going to be starting next week, I believe. I'll get the word out to those founding members. And volunteer with us if you can't support us financially. Here's my wife, Gail, and I. We do tabling events at speaking conferences wherever we go. We talk to people wherever we are about 9/11 and inform them. And so you can help us in so many different ways, such as website development, podcasting technology, which is new, along with social media for me. We've had incredible people. Now, they at AE 911 Truth doing all of these things that I took for granted for at least the last 10 years. And they're the hardest group of people, hardest working group of people that I've had the pleasure to be associated with. Andy Steele, operations manager over there, Kelly David, the chief operating officer, Craig McKee, great writer, Ted Walter, director of strategy and development over there, and Susan with editing, and so many others, Jeff with the website. It's an incredible working group of people. So they need your support also, and volunteers. But here, we need technical writers, foreign language translation, phone calls and outreach, radio and TV interviews, outreach. Maybe you can speak, those. We do make phone calls to engineers and try to find receptive audiences for our radio interviews and our speaking engagements. Video and audio editing, that reminds me. I just had a volunteer today for audio editing. And I almost forgot to write it down. So you can do things on your own. You don't have to join us. You can contact your elected representatives, television, radio, newspaper, reach out to them. Tell everybody you know, architects, engineers, others. Screen the DVDs, share them, and the brochures one-on-one. Download over at AE911Truth, the 130-page report from Professor Leroy Halsey, University of Alaska, and send that out. Send it all around. They made this film, Seven, at AE911Truth. It's a story of Professor Leroy Halsey's process and findings, in which, as we just mentioned, has become the basis for our or AE911Truth's request for correction. And you will want to follow them over at AE911Truth.org for the results of this, because that's now in a lawsuit format, having gone through the appeal process over there. So that's points out several of the points of evidence that we have been going through today. Now, if you make an appointment with your local representative or in DC for your congressman or senator or their staff, I will give the appointment over the phone for you, along with you. And we'll talk to them. We'll give them the 10-minute summary. So please take advantage of that and contact me on our website, richardgage911.org. We'll make that happen. Now, over at AE911Truth, they produced the Bobby McElvain Act. Brilliant work here on the part of Andy Steele and others to make a set of legislation that honors the family members of Bobby, who died in the World Trade Center. He was murdered. He was clearly destroyed. His body was destroyed by explosives. So his father worked so hard, Bob McElvain, to get public awareness and awareness in Congress. So we hope that we'll find a courageous senator or congressman to submit this in either house for this legislation for an investigation. The grand jury investigation, which you may be aware of, now has 60 exhibits that have been sent to the U.S. Attorney General. And that we've submitted filed a lawsuit, a mandamus lawsuit, which requires them to let us know what's going on with regard to this investigation, because it's now been quite a while since we submitted it. The FBI lawsuit is undergoing similar legal extensions, but we're following it up closely, and we have other options to pursue our goals of getting the FBI to release the information to Congress that we've given them, which they were required to do by Congress in the 2015 commission, 9/11 commission review. So we've given them the 24-page peer-reviewed report, Active Thermitic Materials, which, by the way, you can download. Just Google Active Thermitic Materials in the World Trade Center dust, and you'll find it. And you can download that paper and give that out also. But they also commented, the FBI, on our classic DVD, 9/11 Blueprint for Truth. And they said it was backed by thorough research and analysis. But they were legally required to provide all of that evidence that they've collected since the 9/11 Commission report to Congress, and they didn't. So they're getting sued. And these are the kind of efforts that inspired all five commissioners in this local New York area town to sign a resolution calling for a new investigation into the destruction of the towers. You better believe that when the entire fire service of New York State is on board, we'll be an unstoppable force, says Christopher Gioia, former commissioner. And so we also have a classic landmark DVD with 40 high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, physicists, controlled demolition experts, all laying out the evidence for the explosive demolition of the towers. And I just want to play a couple of minutes so that you can get a sense of how important the work is that we're about and how backed up you are by the architects and the engineers.
I don't want to be involved in conspiracy theories. There are lots of them. They can go on. We can speculate on that forever. What we really need to know is how those buildings came down.
World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives or from fuel oil fires.
To undermine scientific integrity is to undermine our democracy.
This is what NIST has done, denied and ignored crucial evidence.
The American people absolutely need the truth of 9/11.
More than 1,500 architects and engineers and 12,000 others, including many scientists, have signed the petition calling for a scientific investigation of the destruction of the Twin Towers and World Trade Center Building 7. The report issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, referred to as NIST, was not valid science.
They're talking about a single columnar collapse or failure that resulted in a total collapse of the building.
Building number 7 descended in free fall for the first 100 feet, which means that there was absolutely no resistance to descent whatsoever.
So all of the columns really needed to be severed at the same time.
The symmetry is the smoking gun.
NIST has admitted it went into free fall for 8 stories.
You don't need to be an engineer or an architect to see what happened to those buildings.
This is controlled demolition. Shake of eight.
What I saw, it was a classic implosion. The center of the core, the penthouse area, starts to move first, and then the building follows along with it.
NIST excluded the documents from FEMA and Appendix C that documented the evidence of melting steel.
In an office fire, you cannot generate enough heat to melt steel.
There were these iron microspheres present in all of the dust samples. They needed to have been formed in extremely high temperatures.
All the characteristics of the microspheres, along with what I see in the attack of the beams that were actually found, tell me that thermite was involved.
In the dust, what we have found is a modern version of thermite, which we call nanothermite.
NIST concedes that they found no evidence for explosives. So then we asked them, well, did you look? And they said, no, we did not look for explosives or residues of explosives.
And in fact, the evidence is overwhelming that these retrograde crystals are very high temperature incendiaries.
And we have watched as scientific integrity has been undermined. Scientific research politicized. in an effort to advance predetermined ideological agendas.
If this is a crime, I think everybody agrees it's a crime. Evidence was removed from the scene of the crime. You can't do science when you are deprived of the evidence and when your hypothesis is the least valid instead of the most likely. And the most likely hypothesis in the case of Building 7 wasn't even mentioned. This is not science.
And yes, you can watch that free on YouTube, the one-hour version of this landmark documentary. And 9/11 explosive evidence experts speak out. You can also get the 90-minute version on over at AE911 Truth on their store. A store packed with incredible amount of great materials you can use for your outreach, including a 50-page booklet that they have, Beyond Misinformation, created by Ted Walter, just pulls the rug completely out from underneath NIST. Great quality pamphlet that you can also download for free on the website at AE911Truth or beyondmisinformation.org over there. And you can get the classic lecture that that I gave, 9/11 Blueprint for Truth, free on YouTube as well. And the film, Solving the Mystery of World Trade Center 7, with actor Ed Asner. And so hopefully next week we'll be prepared to take your questions, and because I can't function and read questions at the same time. I do need assistance with that one. And so what we've been looking at today is the evidence for the explosive demolition of World Trade Center Building 7. This is part one of a three-part series of our webinar, 9/11, An Architect's Guide. So encourage you to come back next week as we delve into part two, the Twin Towers' explosive destruction, where we dive into the evidence of explosions. Look at the sudden near freefall collapse of that building and analyze the physics of it, the high-velocity lateral ejections, the shattering of the steel frame, the midair pulverization of concrete, very explosive evidence. And the week after, on Tuesday at 1 o'clock, part three, we go into the extreme heat, looking again at the high-rise fires, the deeper look into the pyroclastic-like clouds, molten steel and iron microspheres. We tie it all together in a much more comprehensive way with thermite and nanothermite. So I want to thank everybody for joining me on my new venture at richardgage911.org. We have a lot of exciting things planned, including a podcast, a video podcast, which I will be starting this Thursday. In fact, we'll have Barbara Honegger, who has done some amazing research into the anthrax attacks, which are directly tied to 9/11. And nobody explains this more clearly than her. We'll also have Graham McQueen, Professor Graham McQueen, on with that subject and, of course, others that he's done so much incredible research with. So join me Thursday at 7 p.m. Pacific for Barbara Honegger interview right here at richardgage911.org. Thanks so much for joining me, everybody. Really appreciate it. And we'll see you on the webinar a week from today, Tuesday, 1 o'clock. Bye for now.